Coming to you from the West Coast, this is Politicos. Today is January 18th, 2018, and this is episode 69, Giggity Giggity. Politicos is your source for West Coast Canadian politics. I just turned 32, I can make whatever jokes I want still. If you haven't already, please make sure to subscribe and leave a review wherever you found us. Follow us on Facebook and Twitter, where we're at Politicos Pod, and support the show at patreon.com/politicos.
I'm Scott.
And I'm Ian. This might be a new feature, or if you hate it, we'll just cut it, let us know. But we're going to feature music from different local artists each week to kick off our show. Ian Cromwell, who runs Locals Lounge, which you should look up if you like local musicians and learning about their stories. We'll throw a link in the show notes. He helped us set this up. This week's music is Let's Go Shopping from Adam Bailey. You can find his music at adambailey.bandcamp.com or find the link in our show notes. On today's show, we have an interview with UBC economist Kevin Milligan on the minimum wage. We have a grab bag of just random stories to fill the time, and we'll once again check in on the best of BC Poly. But before that, we have to, as usual, thank our premier sponsors, Lindsay Teds and Blake Hodson, for help making this show possible. First up, here's our interview that we recorded earlier this week on one of the like six times we saw each other this week. There was just a lot of parties and pub nights. And I feel like I saw you more than my wife this week. Our interview with Kevin Milligan. We're sitting down with Kevin Milligan, professor at UBC. Why don't you introduce yourself for those who haven't come across your work before?
I'm Kevin Milligan. I'm a professor of economics at the Vancouver School of Economics at the University of British Columbia. Been there since 2001. I'm on Twitter. People know me from that. I do research in the areas of public finance and labor economics. I advise governments, and I'm a longtime listener, first time attendee at the podcast here.
Well, it's great to have you on. We love having listeners on.
So you start us off with giving us a kind of overview of what the research on the minimum wage shows.
The research on the minimum wage, you know, it's a bit of a Rorschach test, you know, inkblot test. People seem very convinced that they see what they want to see in it often. So I think it is a bit of a mixed bag in some circumstances, you can see evidence that there's going to be an employment hit to some groups if there's a large enough increase in the minimum wage in a short enough time period. In contrast, if it's something that is more modest, is in line with increases in the average wage, then it's less likely to have any employment impact. But beyond that rather stale and tired debate, I think a really important thing comes out of some research by my colleague, David Green at UBC. He's found in research with his co-author, Pierre Brochu from University of Ottawa, that when the minimum wage goes up, what tends to happen is, yeah, you see fewer people hired, so hiring goes down, but so do separations. People don't leave their job as easily, and firms don't let people go so easily. And what tends to happen is, when a job is paid more, both the employer and the employee tend to take it more seriously. So the employer tends to invest more in the job and create a better job. If you're going to be paying $15 an hour for this person, you might as well make it worth your time. You're going to get $15 an hour worth of productivity out of them by investing more in them. And that can be something that can, if circumstances are right, lead to a great boost for the economy, in that we have a higher wage, higher skill economy that's boosted by the minimum wage. So that can happen as well, which is not to say it's all sunshine and fluffy clouds. Also, from David Green's research, you find that, you know, certain demographics like teenagers, people just starting off in the workforce, do tend to have a negative employment effect, again, depending on the size and the speed of an increase. So there's a longish answer. It's a bit of a mixed bag, but I think it's important to dig into some of those subtleties to understand that it's not just, you know, a black or white issue.
A lot of this conversation has been kicked off very recently by Ontario's big jump, which politically was probably motivated by Kathleen Wynne's desire to cling to power and so throw some red meat out there. But what stands out there is the fact that they're jumping so fast. They jumped, what was it, like $2 this last year, just on January 1st. So was that too fast?
I think it was like $2.40 even. It was very big. I'm going to draw on some Twitter evidence from a good source. Trevor Tome from the University of Calgary has tweeted out some graphs showing that this jump is bigger than almost anything we've seen in, you know, the past 40 years in Canada of minimum wage increases. Which is why, you know, people drawing on evidence, it's good to look at evidence and try to base your policies on evidence. When you have policy changes so big, so fast, you know, you can take guidance from the evidence and the research, but we are kind of out there, way out there on a limb, and we'll see what happens. An interesting thing is, you know, StatsCan turns around the labor force survey really quickly these days in less than a month. So, you know, by the time we get to election season in Ontario, we're going to have like 3 or 4 months of data on this. And for a jump that big, it wouldn't surprise me if, you know, you can pick that out pretty easily. And I think there will be a few people who are going to dig into that data to look before the election comes up. So I think actually we'll have a fairly good sense fairly soon of which side is going to win at least the battle in the short run.
Well, Ontario is on the path towards $15 an hour minimum wage. I believe NetSteer is when they're implementing that. But the $15 number, something that's being kind of seized on as a rallying point, does the research really suggest that 15 is the right number, and should it be the same in Toronto and Wawa?
Yeah, this has been an argument I've seen out there that, you know, why is it that in the U.S. with Bernie Sanders and $15 and federally $15 and Alberta, Ontario, BC, why always $15? It's a political rallying point. But that's totally fine. Why is it that people say taxes ought to be under 50%? People who like to think that the top marginal tax rate ought to be under 50%. Why? Is because it's a rallying point. I don't think it's a bad thing to have a political rallying point around something. I think that you can make an evidence-based argument that minimum wage ought to be higher. You make a values-based argument that minimum wage ought to be higher. Does it need to be right at 15? Is there science that says it ought to be 15.00? No. But there's not science that says that the carbon tax ought to be, you know, $50 a ton, 50.00 in every province for every industry. Rural BC is different than urban BC. And you could imagine having lots of things, tax rates and government things that would vary to one's particular circumstances. But that's not the way we do things. So I think it's fine to have the same minimum wage in a variety of circumstances. And I think it's fine as a political rallying point to have it at $15 as a target. Is it fine to do it as quickly as Ontario has done it? Well, we will see in a few months. I am a bit skeptical that it's going to, you know, pass by easily without any disruptions in the labor market, because again, it's such a big jump so quickly.
One thing people point to rather than the $15 target is, well, that's not even enough because the living wage, like here in Vancouver, has been set around $21, $22 an hour. I imagine Toronto's pretty similar. In Kelowna, it's probably half that or something. But the question arises, how do people come up with this living wage calculation? And should that be where we move the minimum wage to?
That discussion of the living wage brings into the discussion talking about wages versus income. Wages is what one person gets from a job. Income is what some unit, maybe a family, maybe a couple, whatever they might be, have in order to meet their living needs. Those things are different concepts. I've been talking about the benefit to the economy of having better quality jobs. People have an economy where there's a job that's good, that feel respected and valued and well compensated. That's one thing. I didn't say anything about poverty yet. I didn't say anything about addressing poverty. I'm not really convinced that minimum wage is a great anti-poverty tool for exactly that reason. If you make some nice scientific calculation that the income level in Vancouver is this much and in Kelowna is that much, that's great. But there are a variety of ways you can get to that income level, a combination of different people in the household working. Some households have one worker, some have multiple. That's why I don't find discussion of a living wage to be as compelling as, talking about income levels and what are tools that can help people get out of poverty and have enough money to meet their basic decent living needs.
Well, on that topic, there's a bunch of other possible interventions the government could be looking at to address poverty, you know, up the working income tax benefit. There's always talk of a negative income. What are your thoughts on those and how they compare to the minimum wage?
There certainly are other tools available. Of course, thinking back to the politics for a moment, with those other things, that whether it's increased transfers or whether it's a working tax benefit, those all cost you tax dollars, whereas mandating someone else to pay someone a minimum wage doesn't cost you tax dollars. You can wave around a flag and put out Twitter declarations about how awesome your government is. Doesn't cost you anything, though. So there's a big difference there. You have to pay for it with real dollars, not just rhetoric. So a couple of the options. The working income tax benefit is something we have federally. The building blocks are there for a solid program. In Canada, though, the working income tax benefit is weak right now. Part of the reason is it's almost entirely gone by the time you hit the low $20,000 of income. So if you're talking to someone who's a minimum wage, full-time, full-year worker doing all those things, getting up in the morning, working hard for her family, you don't get any working income tax benefit. That's kind of like missing the target, I think. So it phases out too early. Why is it phased out too early? It's because if they allow you to keep it higher up the income distribution, it costs the government more money. And so they just haven't put enough resources into it. The other thing that I have some problem with it is the way it's delivered. It's kind of buried on the tax form. Most people don't even know it exists. If you're going to make an argument that we want to have, you know, you draw this nice economic diagram with, you know, how much benefit you get for how many hours of work. And we like to draw those diagrams in economics. But if no one actually knows how this thing works and doesn't actually see it, I'm not sure it actually changes anyone's behavior. So I think we need to make it more visible and have to make it more generous. Good news is, in the fall economic statement, the federal government announced they were putting more money into the WHITB. I know that in Ottawa, various models are being bounced around of how they're going to do that. I presume we're going to find out in the budget in whenever that will be, February or March. At the BC level, there is other things we can do. There are different provinces have earned income supplements, kind of add-ons to the WHITB, complements to the WHITB. So there's some things we can do here in BC on that front. So there are other measures available, but the difficult part about that is you have to actually spend some dollars at the provincial government to use them.
Going back to the minimum wage, but moving maybe to Alberta, mm-hmm. they've also been moving towards $15, and they're actually aiming to get there this year, but they just went up to $13.60 in October, I believe. But it doesn't seem to have sparked as much outcry as in Ontario. Is that just a factor of not jumping as quick as fast, or do you think there's some political differences there, or even just policy differences?
I think both of those things that you mentioned. One is that it was phased in a bit more slowly than the Ontario one. The other factor is just thinking about the economy in Alberta. Of course, when the oil crisis, shall we call it, the oil challenges hit in 2015, this made a big difference. But before that, I mean, if you spent some time in Alberta, I spent some time a few times in northern Alberta, and you see the signs on the McDonald's and on the Tim Hortons, we're hiring $19 an hour, $18 an hour. So my sense is the proportion of people who are earning the minimum wage in Alberta, I don't have these data in front of me, my strong guess would be that the proportion of people on the minimum wage were much lower in Alberta than was the case in Ontario. And so it simply wasn't as binding, and so you didn't hear the same kind of complaints that you heard in Ontario.
Well, there was a study put out from CD Howe by Joseph Marchand suggesting that the Alberta's wage increase to $15 an hour cost 25,000 jobs. Has there been any evidence so far from their early bumps up of the wage, whether or not that's come to fruition?
So I haven't seen any evidence from Alberta yet. Because they phased in a bit more slowly, it's not clear that you'd see the big bump that we may see in Ontario when it comes out. That study by Joseph Marchand, he's from the University of Alberta, and you can find it at cdhowe.org. I think it's a really good study to read, and part of the reason is it digs a bit more deeply into some of the more complex parts of the labor market. People often, you know, I've read too many op-eds over the past couple of weeks saying, everyone knows demand curves slope down. If you increase the wages, then firms are going to hire less people, and it's clearly just going to end up hurting the workers. That can be true in certain kinds of markets. If it's a textbook Eco 100, perfectly competitive market and perfectly competitive labor market, that can happen. But there are a lot of markets out there that are not from Eco 100 textbook. If you have, you know, franchises with a lot of brand power in there, they have a bit of monopolistic pricing power. You can have labor markets that are not very fluid. These things can all lead to theoretical predictions that are actually the opposite of that. And very smart economists who study the labor markets I can tell you that you can generate predictions from real economic models that suggest that higher minimum wages can actually increase employment in certain circumstances in certain industries. And so what's good, what I liked about Marchand's paper for C.D. Howe was he took a look at those different models and tried to assess how they apply, how they don't. In the end, he came down to suggest that there would be an employment cost there, and that's still reasonable. But what I liked is he considered the other possibilities of the labor market and not just kind of, you know, I tried to apply simple equal 100 logic to a world that's much more complex than that.
Well, on that topic, there was a Bank of Canada paper that got a similar amount of press, I think even more, in fact, about Ontario, and I believe 60,000 was the number they used, and was obviously too soon to know if it's going to come true. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, that was the very, very partisan Bank of Canada, right? I remember the Twitter backlash to that, where people were trying to call the Bank of Canada this like conservative think tank. But that's Twitter.
Yeah, that would be Twitter. In my experience, the people at Bank of Canada would rather walk over hot coals than embed themselves in a political debate like that. Mm-hmm. So both the economists and the leadership there would have that view, I think. On that, I saw lots of debate about that. I thought the estimate looked reasonable from what they considered. I saw some people trying to dismiss it as, oh, it's a drop in the bucket. The labor market's very dynamic. Yeah, that's true, but I don't know that I want to poo-poo 60,000. 60,000 is a big number. Political careers have been ended by a lot less than 60,000 people losing their jobs. So I think that's a real number. I don't think it's the final number. I think it's an interesting piece of analysis. Again, I think we will see over the next few months with such a sharp increase in Ontario, I think we will have a better sense of where things may be softer and where there may be a soft underbelly to this policy. Where I would look for that is specifically in the teenager labor market. That's one where I would expect to see an impact if there is going to be one. And that would happen fairly quickly. So I think we'll have some answers soon.
One of the other studies I saw you tweet out when someone was asking for Econ 100 level discussions of this was from the Canadian Center for Policy Alternatives, and they've been pushing hard for $15 minimum wage here in BC. Their recent recommendations for the commission that came out this past week, this Fair Wage Commission that we were talking about just before we went on, which is, you know, one of the many task force and commissions that a new government that maybe didn't expect to win ends up doing, I guess. Their recommendation was basically from the CCPA, let's do a front-loaded increase, jump to $13 in March of this year, and then $14 in September and $15 by next March. And that would be up from the $11.35 right now. Do you think that's a good path to go, or do you think that's maybe too steep? Would you smooth that out a little bit?
Yeah, the study you mentioned is by David Green, my colleague I was citing earlier. He wrote for the Canadian Center for Policy Alternatives here in Vancouver. And it's, again, I think a really nicely done work. He talks about some of his other research I was mentioning about the idea that with higher wages, the firms are going to invest more in their employees and that kind of positive, virtuous cycle that we hope could happen. And he makes a good case for it. He also talks about just the moral aspect of it. He brings in both the, you know, hard economic efficiency, but also the hard moral case that this is a good thing to do. So he defends those views very well. So I recommend that paper for people to read as well. As for those kinds of recommendations, you know, I'm guided by the idea that comes out of the research that what matters is kind of the relationship of the minimum wage to the average wage and proportion of people that are earning the minimum wage. And that's a good guide to, you know, what kind of impact we should expect. So in this case, moving very quickly, well, I want to see how far are we off the historical norms of the ratio of the minimum wage to the average wage. And if we're quite a bit below, maybe there's some room for some catch up. But in general, I'd be more apt to suggest that I take it a bit slow approach is a good one to do. But again, we'll learn a lot, excuse me, over the next few months from looking at Ontario. But also, knowing a few people on the Fair Wage Commission, my suspicion when we see their report is that we're not going to see a recommendation for something super fast. That they're going to be a bit more of a take it slow approach. And that's just my guess, knowing some of the personalities involved. We'll see what they recommend. And we'll see what the government then does with the recommendation. And just to that point about all of the various commissions and committees that are out there, there's the one on MSP chaired by Lindsay Tedds.
We know her.
Yes, friend of the pod. This one, and there's also some other committees and reports that are out there. I think it's great that the a government with a minority situation in the House is still taking the time to try to get the policies right. I really like that approach. Talking to people who've studied these things for all their life, people who are economics professors or think tank researchers, we don't have all the wisdom and we should not be making the decisions. But I do think it's useful to ask us what we think, and then a government duly elected by the people should make those decisions with some good information in their hands. And I see that that's what this government has been doing, and I think that's the right approach to policy.
One of the other things I've seen provinces talk about, or at least a lot of people suspect or ask why we don't do, is just tie something like the minimum wage to inflation or consumer price index or some metric.
Yeah, so we don't have to come back to this debate every 2 years.
Yeah, that's a good question. Those who know more about the minimum wage than I do might tell you that maybe that's happened before, but we certainly do that in the tax system. You might recall that in the 70s and until 1986, I want to say, the tax system was fully indexed, the income tax system. And then we partially de-indexed it as of the mid-80s. It was not re-indexed again until, I want to say, the budget of 2000. So we spent 15 years with inflation eating away various tax deductions and credits in our tax system and the thresholds to get a new tax bracket. Starting in 2000, we automatically re-indexed them. And I think that's the right thing to do. It's curious why that approach isn't taken also for the minimum wage. It makes a lot of sense to me. You could index it to prices, you could also index it to a measure of the average wage. That ratio, like I said, is an important one from the research that says that, you know, that ratio of minimum wage to average wage is key. Why not index it to that? That makes a lot of sense to me.
I did a quick Google, and StatsCan has a nice listing of all the provincial minimum wages, and Saskatchewan was the only one with the footnote of it's actually indexed to CPI. Mm. But it's still approved by cabinet, I guess. So they could still veto it if they decide people aren't worth a raise that year.
Sure. I think still having that as the default does matter because it does cause you to go off that default. If the government is going to deny people that increase, they're going to have to do a press conference, stand in front of a microphone and take the political hit for that. So I think it still does matter, even if they do end up vetoing it. But I think that's an approach that I could have some merit.
So I want to pick on something you said a couple times now, is that sometimes the downsides are concentrated with particular groups. You've mentioned teenagers. There are probably maybe one or two other ones. Do you have any thoughts on that? Can you maybe expand upon it and whether or not that concentrated downside means we should be a little more cautious about messing with the minimum wage?
That's tough. When you're making policies, you know, what's great is when you're sitting there as a decision maker and your expert committee recommends these things. Here's a change you can make. It hurts no one. It benefits everyone. But you know what? There's not a lot of those out there. That's the low-hanging fruit, and that's already been picked. Most things that hit you as a top decision maker are reaching you at a top decision maker because there are no easy decisions. If it was easy, it would have been made by someone else at some other time. So you have to make these trade-offs as a policymaker, and it's tough. You're looking at something where potentially you're going to make it harder for new Canadians, make it harder for teenagers to enter the job market and get that vital stepping stone into a life where they can be productive in the labor market. And that's what a lot of people want to do. So that's tough. If you make it harder for them, but at the same time, you make life potentially a lot better for a lot of people. You can make jobs more pleasant, make them better, higher quality jobs. That's very tempting. Figuring out how to trade that off is why we have elected representatives. We have to then face the electorate and be responsible and accountable for those decisions. But it is tough. And that's something that a lot of policymakers have to face every day is how do we trade off and who do we throw under the bus and who do we grab a hand and give a lift up.
Well, teenagers don't vote, so it makes it easy.
Actually, 14-year-olds can apparently vote for the Saskatchewan Party leader. They let them. Wow. Yeah. The last question on minimum wage I really had was at the federal level. One of the things the NDP ran on in the last election, I think all of the leadership candidates re-endorsed, was this idea of a $15 an hour national minimum wage that would apply to federally regulated industries. Just because I forget the number, do you remember roughly how many people that applies to? And because that would supersede the minimum wage in each province, would there be any sort of upward pressure on wages in provinces where the minimum wage is still like $10.50?
The minimum wage, labor market regulation in Canada is a question of what industry you're in. Mm-hmm. Certain industries are federally regulated, so banking, transportation, federal civil servants are regulated by the federal government. So your maternity leave rules, your recourse if you're fired without cause, and those kinds of things are governed by the federal government if you're in a federally regulated industry, and by provincial governments if you're in a provincially regulated industry. I don't have the number in front of me. I want to say it's around 5% of the workforce is in a federally regulated industry. It's fairly small. So it was not the case that it superseded the word that you said. It was if the federal government had moved to a $15 minimum wage right away in 2015, that would have affected only federally regulated industries directly. And the thing is about those industries, banking and transportation and federal civil servants, and they're all fairly well compensated. The proportion of people who are be affected by the $15 minimum wage was actually really, really small, which led to some of the debate around the 2015 election on the, you know, when the federal NDP was proposing this. They said, yeah, it's just a symbol, but symbols are important. And that's a good argument that, yeah, symbols are important. If they had shown leadership, perhaps Ontario would have followed more quickly to $15. Maybe BC would have had more pressure to do so. And so that, I think that's a solid argument that symbols are important. The counter argument to that was, yeah, but if your number one economic policy that you're putting on the table for Canadians is just a symbol, maybe there's other options on the table than just doing a symbol. Symbols are good, but maybe we should do something beyond just a symbol. So that was a flavor of the debate of the 2015 election that I just got a chance to revisit. But yeah, I think now that we're a couple years down the road, what should happen in 2019 for that? Provinces have already moved up. You have Ontario, you have BC. We'll see what happens in BC. Ontario and Alberta are moving to 15. BC is almost surely going to move in that direction. You know, now the federal government will be paying catch up more than anything, but still the minimum wage at the federal level isn't a really important policy tool because of the fact that it covers so few people. If I was, I'd have some FaceTime with the cabinet and they asked me what would be important to help low-income Canadians, I would say spend more time thinking about the WIPI, the working income tax benefit, try to get that right, try to get more people who receive it farther up the income distribution, try to make sure that's more visible so people know what's going on, that they actually get this bonus check. If they work more, they get a bigger bonus check. That's a good thing, and we want people to know about that. That's purely within the federal government's mandate and within their jurisdiction. I think that's where they should focus their time.
Okay, well, with that, tell our listeners where they can find you.
I can be found on Twitter at Kevin Milligan, and that's the best place to find me.
All right. Well, thank you for coming on the show. Hopefully we'll have you back soon.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. And moving on to Quit Takes. The fundraising data finally came out for the by-election that was held here back in October. And, well, turns out Vision pulled in a lot of dollars despite its rather lackluster showing. They raised $278,000 in contributions, although they held on to most of that, spending only $77,000. So this comes well ahead of the $53,700 the NPA raised. But despite all of that, it didn't really seem to do them much good, and that they came in a dismal fifth.
Vision was definitely pulling in a lot of corporate and union donations while they still can. Right after the by-election is when the province brought in new laws that mean going forward, everyone's going to have to rely on small individual donations, or small up to $1,200, I think it is, roughly in that range, maybe $1,500. Go back and listen to our old shows. Vision Vancouver, though, received just $26,000 from individuals versus $222,000 from corporations and $29,000 from unions. So they basically just took all that money, stuffed it in the bank, and now have a war chest for maybe their last campaign. It's a strategy. NPA spent most of the money it raised. They did spend $79,000. Gene Swanson, interestingly, pulled in $43,000. Almost all of that was from individuals, except for $1,100 that came from a union or a couple unions. and she ended up spending most of that. The Greens similarly raised about $45,000 and spent not actually as much. They sort of split their spending between the Green Party return and Pete Fry's personal return. So between that, they spent maybe $15,000. They also, we didn't look at the school board returns, spent some money there, which paid off in droves. My favorite number there, though, was that Sensible Vancouver's candidate, Mary Jean Dudson Watermelon, more famously, spent over $52,000, much of that coming from things like cannabis culture and some of the most prominent cannabis activists in the city. Now, she got some press for that, but did she get $52,000 worth of press when that's in the range of what, say, the NPA was spending?
I would say not, especially considering she only pulled in 1,737 votes, which makes those very expensive votes. But yeah, I think the interesting lesson to draw from this is just how little money actually made a difference in the end on this. By far the biggest fundraiser and spender came in fifth, and you know, that I think just goes to show how people can sometimes overestimate the effect money has in politics, and no amount of money can save a very unpopular party or candidate.
It was still incredible, though, how much money went to Vision just in terms of the corporate fundraising. Like,
yeah, nobody likes them anymore, but they clearly have a well-oiled fundraising machine.
Well, and Hector Bremner ran on the, I want to basically let everyone build everything. And that's the kind of campaign you would expect developers to just shovel money at. And they did give him some. They gave him enough, but they weren't giving in the six-figure range that Vision pocketed. So, I don't know. Maybe NPA is still like waiting to build up there. Well, I guess they can't reach into those corporate pockets now.
Yeah, and you know, yeah, a lot of developers, I'm sure, would be happy with it. But some of the really big ones, you know, they're not all that upset about some of the restrictions and red tape they face, because it's a barrier to entry for their smaller competition.
It is impressive, though, to see how much Gene Swanson was able to bring in, almost all from individual donors. They list on each of these how many people had donations that were under $100, and she had almost 500 sub-$100 donors, which are the more like realistic. By comparison, Vision had 50. So she had 10 times the grassroots support, effectively. But this gives a sense of where things are going to line up for this fall. We have Vision with tons of cash in its pockets, NPA with a fairly streamlined machine. They're able to raise what they need. They don't have the big donations yet. And even the grassroots campaign of a Gene Swanson type can work because there is an appetite for that. And not just to make noise on Twitter, but people were willing to put $43,000 up for it. While we're on the municipal scene, the other story that came out today was that the Vancouver Aquarium has thrown in the towel on the cetacean fight. We talked about this last year a couple times as the Parks Board had brought in a bylaw that said there's not going to be whales in captivity anymore. And then the aquarium said, no, we're going to fight this in court. And they hired a fancy pants lawyer. And we had Micah explain the interesting aspects of that lawsuit, including the freedom of expression elements.
Even for the non-lawyer, seemed like a bit of a stretch on that one.
It's my free speech, damn it. But it seems like in the end, the hurdle to try to meet in court and the growing public pressure was too much, and they decided to just give up. They also had, unfortunately, another whale die this last year, Chester, the false killer whale, and they lost both of their belugas recently, so they're down to just Helen, the harbor porpoise, I believe. CEO John Nightingale said today, you also have to be realistic. It's gotten to the point where the debate in the community with the lawyers, with the politicians, is debilitating our work on our mission. And I think he's just had pressure both externally and probably even internally, not to necessarily give up the fight, but to just focus on being an aquarium. And at this point in time, is it worth the charity's all-encompassing effort to fight one legal question, or should they just give up on it and, you know, show off octopus and fishes? So that'll cost the aquarium one of their main sources of revenue, and they still have to figure out what to do with Helen, because they were talking about potentially bringing another dolphin or similar animal in to keep her company, but now that's not going to happen. They'll probably have to transport her to another aquarium, and that'll be a bit risky. It sounds also like they may keep the tanks around for a bit just to potentially use if they do rescue a larger animal or a whale that they need to house somewhere temporarily before they either move it somewhere else or release it if it's able to be. And maybe that'll cause another stink, but it's kind of sad. I like the aquariums and I actually did support their position, but I guess sometimes you just lose those fights, and hopefully we can move on from this and find other petty things to argue about.
It's the parts where they probably will find something petty to argue about. Moving on, Andrew Weaver, the Dream Party leader, has been making some noise about real estate and banning foreign buyers. He's called for BC to follow New Zealand's recently adopted model, as well as seize the assets of people involved in real estate scams.
Yeah, so there's this judgment that just came out of the BC Supreme Court. It sounds like it's a massive 500-page ruling. The summary is basically this foreign buyer had committed immigration fraud and money laundering. He didn't declare foreign income. He pretended to spend time in Canada to meet residency requirements. He hid the fact he owned some real estate. And he was charged with exploiting the courts for costly trials. So just a total mess of a story. And Weaver sees this and decides to go on Twitter and says, the properties involved should be seized. Our lax real estate rules are making us look foolish. And it's just a weird kind of thing to be calling for a politician to be calling for someone who's been ruled against to have their property seized. Like, he's basically trying to direct the courts on how to dole out justice.
Yeah, it's a little weird on that front, and like, I haven't read the details of the case really at all beyond what's briefly mentioned in the news article on it, but you know, there's been some serious questions raised about the idea of civil asset forfeiture, and you know, maybe this isn't the sort of policy we should be looking at to deal with these sorts of things.
Like, if Weaver wants to start talking about seizing things and moving into like full Marxist redistribution of property, we can have a conversation. But this weird sort of intervening in a trial to try to score a political point seems needless.
Needless,
and just
but
random.
Yeah, you know, very common tactic of politicians.
Well, and a very Andrew Weaver thing. Like you were saying, his tweets about New Zealand were catching the eye of the premier and others, and when Von Palmer pitched that to him in the what are you going to be doing this year column, John Horgan said, well, New Zealand's a small set of islands in the South Pacific. BC is the gateway to Canada, and I don't think we should be curbing people from coming here. And then he went on to try to pitch a foreign buyer's ban as xenophobic and racist, which there can be elements of that in many of the calls, but you can make, I think, a non-racist case for it.
Trouble is, those aren't always the ones that end up flowing up to the surface on this.
And Weaver's been towing a sort of back and forth line of, we should ban all the foreigners. And then people are like, what exactly do you mean by that? And he's like, well, clearly I mean the exact specific thing we said in our platform. But maybe Twitter's just not the good place to have a robust policy debate if you're someone who likes to stay up late. He also got into it because, I guess, in one of his year-end interviews, perhaps with DSmog blog or someone like that, he said LNG would be an issue where he would bring the government down. And so in this Von Palmer column, John Horgan talks about, oh, he's going over to Asian markets to try to talk up BC LNG, I guess following in the Christy Clark footsteps, hoping that this time it'll work, but still trying to sell it and with more strict conditions in this case. And Weaver is now tweeting this week that he would bring down the government if it goes ahead with LNG. He said it's a hashtag line in the sand. Even, which is a lot of talk, but it's not like there's going to be a confidence vote on LNG.
Yeah, LNG wouldn't trigger a confidence vote unless it's part of the budget and he's willing to defeat the government over the budget, and that only works also if the Liberals want an election at the same time, because those three votes don't matter when the Liberals, 41 votes, can, you know, easily push things or over the threshold on that one and keep the confidence. So it's going to be hard for him to force an election. Also, just strategically stupid if he does this before the referendum on PR.
LNG is in the Liberals' platform manifesto. It's in their soul. I think they bleed LNG, right? This is their modus operandi. If anything, I'd almost expect a few Liberals to either vote with the NDP on this just to spite the Greens, or just stay home, and then it's easy for the NDP to win the vote.
Yeah, the Liberals have no incentive except trying to make a naked political calculation that they could win an election at that time to bring down the government over LNG.
Well, and we've seen that happen in BC. All summer, the Liberals' fake throne speech was forcing the NDP and Greens to vote against their own policies. So politicians in BC will vote against them when they decide they don't like the other party, and I don't think there's any love between them. But it creates an interesting dynamic where you could have the Liberals siding with the NDP despite the Greens, or you could just have them. Like, who do they hate more? Do they hate Weaver or do they hate Horgan more? Probably Horgan, but...
Yeah, and coming up pretty quickly on having an actual official leader rather than Coleman's interim period, which I don't think they've recorded themselves particularly well during that. So maybe the new guy will be a little more level-headed on some of this stuff, because I could definitely see Coleman in a moment of partisan dislike to the NDP throwing caution to the wind and on this.
Triggering an election the day before, like, the leadership vote? It probably won't come to that, but fun times.
Overall, this whole thing just seems an empty threat on Weaver's part that he won't be able to follow through on.
So we'll keep watching LNG as the next flashpoint in this province. Well, the other thing to watch in the next few weeks is John Horgan has announced the date for the Kelowna West by-election, and it's going to be on Valentine's Day.
Yeah, so if you're in Kelowna West and looking for something romantic to do, you can stand in line at a polling station.
And hopefully there will be a good turnout. I was looking at some of the past data, and the 2013 by-election, which happened right after the 2013 election because Christy Clark needed a seat to run her government, actually had a fairly similar turnout in terms of raw votes to the full election. I think the vote share stayed roughly the same or went up a little for the Liberals. This is going to be a very hard seat for anyone but the Liberals to win. The Greens are really hoping to try to pull something off here. They've nominated Robert Stupka, who seems like a reasonable candidate. We talked about him in the fall. He's an engineer, works a lot in green tech. The NDP are running Shelley Cook, who they ran in the last election. And the Liberals are running Ben Stewart, who was the MLA there before Christy Clark needed a seat. So he's party loyalist and former MLA, and he's probably got a reasonable shot there. In the last election last year, the Liberals took 60% there to the NDP's 25% and the Greens 13%. So it's hard to find a path for anyone to knock the Liberals off. Maybe if the Liberal voters are just really disillusioned with how the party's behaved in the last year almost, and just to stay home. But even then,
that's pretty unlikely.
Like, by-elections have lower turnout, but it's usually fairly uniform. And if anything, the NDP is not in favoring themselves to interior voters right now. So maybe the Greens and NDP will switch spots, but still stay in the...
Turnout's not going to fall so much that it can close a 35-point gap.
The only other thing I'll say about by-elections is the key numbers to always watch are just the raw votes and how those shift from the previous election. If you look just at percentages, you can read a lot into them when it might not be something there. So if the Greens go up from the roughly 3,000 votes, I think, or if the NDP goes up or down from the 6,000 votes they got, then that makes a bigger difference than if suddenly the percentages change a lot.
And the only other thing I'll add to this is, this is going to be the first by-election with the new Liberal leader. So no word yet on how that's going to shake. I imagine it's not going to make much of a difference one way or the other, but nevertheless, it's interesting.
If it's Diane Watts, she'll need a seat to run in, so there might have to be another by-election.
Yeah, that is true. Although her campaign doesn't seem to be doing that well. Actually, on the way over here, I got a phone call from her campaign with a rather nervous and sounded somewhat dejected person on the other end, which I've done those calls. They're sometimes not fun, but like it's when they don't sound enthusiastic about it, it's not a great sign. Well, moving on, so we got some polling data about what British Columbians think about the Site C decision. So Angus Reid released a survey this past week that they conducted back in December. And overall, it shows the Site C decision at 23% support, 26% opposed, and 52% unsure. So overall, the province is pretty split on the issue.
Yeah, when you break down the political parties support or opposition of the NDP's decision to go ahead with the building the dam, pluralities of Greens actually support the decision by within margin of error kind of area, but it shows that they're probably not burning bridges in their party. There are definitely stalwarts and hardened opinions on both sides, but for most NDP supporters, for most Green supporters, they're like, all right, fine. And of course, BC Liberals are hyper partisan on this, with like 78% very supportive and just like a half a dozen who are like, no, actually, we don't like the one big thing our party has tried to do in the last decade. And that partisanship comes through in another question they asked about proportional representation versus first past the post, where support for proportional representation has actually dropped from 65% in a similar poll they did in September down to 57%. And most of that comes from BC Liberals becoming hyper-polarized on the issue.
Well, more polarized. Yeah, so they dropped from 52% support a new system, which is margin of error within, you know, being undecided on the issue, down to 36% between September and December.
So their votes are moving. They haven't abandoned the idea of changing the electoral system, but you see only subtle shifts in the Liberals and Greens. So this is good news on the Site C stuff for John Horgan, but puts the referendum a bit more up in the air of which way it could go. And given that things have started off pretty strongly on the no camp, because there is no yes campaign yet, because there's no question to answer, it creates a bit of a uphill battle.
Yeah, it's also interesting that the Green Party itself came out very strongly opposed to this, where it looks like their supporters... yeah, are a lot more unsure of the Site C decision.
Something that I noticed Keith Baldry and a lot of the commentators have really picked up on, and they try to emphasize it, but one thing that you do notice is someone who identifies himself as a NDP supporter or a Green supporter in these surveys aren't necessarily the party activists or the party members. So you can still win over the people who support you, but if you lose your base, your core supporters, which are harder to tell in these kind of surveys, because this survey was, I guess, part of a giant Canada-wide one where they did 5,400 people nationwide so they could pull out almost 700 BC residents. It's hard to figure out who's a party member and who's the person who's doing a lot versus the person who may or may not vote for you when it comes election day. That said, I still think the NDP is probably going to get away with this in the end, and other issues are going to come up more fiercely. LNG is probably a little bit more polarizing. The Kinder Morgan pipeline is going to be pretty fierce. Even if that similarly has a breakdown, the people who are opinionated on it are very opinionated on it.
Yeah. So the only other thing I'm going to make a quick note of here is the gender breakdown on Site C was quite interesting, where overall the province was pretty split on it. Two-thirds of men and only a third of women think the Site C decision was the right one.
I wonder if they're compensating for something. Just most British Columbian men just need to see something bigger out there to feel better about themselves. Hashtag toxic masculinity. There's what we can name the dam. Well, moving to other things to polarize at least Metro Vancouver, a preliminary report from the Road Pricing Commission has come out, and there's not a ton of detail in there, but they have managed to cut the 10 initial options that they were looking at down to just two. And so this is pitched as the government's approach to Well, we got rid of tolls on the two bridges because that system didn't make sense and it made life unaffordable. But road pricing can be a way to reduce congestion, encourage other things, and also pay for TransLink.
Yeah, it's worth pointing out here that the road pricing commission came from the mayor's council. It's not a provincial initiative. The mayor's council has been supportive of this in the past. I'm not actually sure where the new leadership sits around this issue, but yeah, overall, they've been supportive in the past at looking at this. And yeah, the basic theory is right now the roads are effectively free to drive on. When something's free, people overconsume it, you know, take more trips than they need to, put a price on it, people start to ration their trips a little more, gets congestion.
Well, you saw this as soon as the toll dropped off the Portman Bridge. There were stories about huge traffic jams literally the next day.
Yeah.
Because people are like, oh, now the bridge is free, I'm going to take it.
Yeah.
Because it's a nice bridge to drive across.
Oh, it's great.
Not when everyone else is doing it.
But yeah, and that's the thing. It's like, before that toll came down, a lot of people were saying, and unfortunately they weren't listened to, when they were like, no, this is going to cause a traffic problem because you're going to get a surge in demand.
So the commission has come up with its two possibilities. The first is making downtown Vancouver a congestion charge, the way London and some other European cities have done, and then also put charges at pinch points around Metro Vancouver, like tunnels and bridges. I think it would be a bit more consistent, so the Massey Tunnel, the Alex Fraser, and other bridges than just the Portman and Golden Ears, and probably maybe even the two crossings to North Van would also face tolls in that situation, to basically just even it out and make sure it's fair and provide a bit of funding. The other model is something that the report admits has not actually been done anywhere in the world, but I think it's the urban economist's wet dream of charging drivers based on the distance traveled and then also applying a variable location or time-based fee. So if you're driving at rush hour, you pay a bit more than if you stagger your commute by an hour or two even. Or if you drive on weekends, it's cheaper. And you'd need to have some technology involved in this. Maybe put GPS trackers in everyone's cars or something. We already had RFIDs in our cars to drive across the Portman Bridge. And this is how I think London is doing its congestion charges these days. So it's not such an invasive thing, but they are considering privacy concerns around this as well, because it does get worrying if the city has built up a database of where everyone has driven all of the time and can say, oh, that's where Scott was. So they're looking at those two options and going to continue consultations for the next couple months. There's going to be an online survey opening next month, and we'll throw links into the show notes, with the final report coming out in April.
Well, moving from a smarts roads initiative to a very dumb roads controversy, there has been yet another development in the ongoing conflict between Saskatchewan and Alberta over license plates. And this,
we're not calling it Plategate.
We are not.
I'll go for War of the Plates.
This time over where to hold the meeting to discuss the dispute.
The Peace Plate Summit.
Yes. So originally it was proposed for Lloydminster, which is, for those of you who don't know, literally on the border between the two provinces, as in half of Lloydminster is in Saskatchewan, half of it is in Alberta. So, you know, the obvious place to do it. But Saskatchewan, citing travel considerations, wanted to move it to Medicine Hat because it is more equidistant between the two capitals. And CBC did a great little map and diagram on this one of how far it was to each.
They painted in the roads in yellow, and Edmonton to Lloydminster is only 280 kilometers versus 580 from Regina. But Edmonton to Medicine Hat is 530, and it's 466 from Regina to Medicine Hat. So we'll put this in the show notes, or maybe it's the episode title. I haven't decided yet, but it's just the kind of map that someone drew for pretty much everyone who's never been to rural Alberta, I guess, and that's fair. Alberta is saying that they had agreed on this Lloydminster location, but Saskatchewan is still hemming and hawing that no, they never set it in stone or finalized this. And the summit itself, I'm going to call it a summit because it needs to be that epic, was scheduled for the end of the month. And if that isn't reached, and they don't come to an agreement there, because Alberta has filed its initial petitions under the, what is it, the New West Trade Agreement, the Western Canadian provinces do actually have a semi-free trade agreement.
Because this is apparently a thing that has to exist in Canada. But
At the sub-federal level.
Yes. But that is a whole other topic for another time.
If they miss the chance of making an agreement at the end of this month, they'll go to binding arbitration or something. And then maybe they'll figure out if people driving their trucks with Alberta license plates can work on Saskatchewan construction sites or not. Bradwell's not even going to be premier for much longer. I don't know what he's fighting this for, other than just because pissing off the Alberta NDP works for the Saskatchewan Party, and this Alberta NDP pissing off the Saskatchewan Party works for them.
Yeah, all I know is giving us 3 episodes worth of content on what has got to be the pettiest dispute in Canadian federalism, which is a stiff competition.
We had an extended conversation with Mike at the end of last year about whether you can take beer across the border, and this is worse. Or better from the humor point of view, I guess. While we're on the petty and humorous topic, Vancouver City Council this week decided to approve a new bike lane pilot project across the Cambie Bridge. That itself isn't petty or humorous. It's just what we do in Vancouver, especially when you have Gregor Robertson. We build bike lanes.
Yes, of course, people not from here may underestimate just how much oxygen this conversation has sucked up over the past 10 years.
I think I have seen hints of how heated bike lane debates can get in other city, and so it's not necessarily a uniquely Vancouver thing, but we've definitely perfected the art of faux outrage over relatively trivial infrastructure projects. So council approved this $600,000 pilot project. They're going to take one lane of the southbound Cambie Bridge, which is a 6-lane bridge that flows into 4 lanes on each end. So it has extra capacity that it can't use. It's also had dropping traffic over the last few years because people are biking and
well, the Canada Line runs underneath it.
Taking transit. So they're going to build this bike lane, and they can do it really quick. Apparently it will be done later this spring because all they need to do is put some concrete barriers down. But for whatever reason, the NPA decided to plant their flag on this issue, and George Affleck submitted amendments to place a moratorium on bike lanes, and he wanted staff to consider other innovative crossings for False Creek, like maybe an entirely new bicycle bridge or cantilever a bridge, like glue a extra lane of bridge onto the side of the Cambie Bridge for just bicycles. Someone else pointed out that the city has studied this in the past, and the standalone bridge would probably be $100 million, and the cantilever extension would be $60 million. So his proposal was 100 times more expensive than the project vision put forward and voted for, which is your fiscally responsible party.
You just got to shake your head at this one. Just the NPA has been trying for, what, 3 elections now to make bike lanes a wedge issue, and it's never worked for them.
And the by-election where they didn't talk about bike lanes, they managed to win.
Yeah. They pushed the vision down to 5th place, and they didn't talk about bike lanes once. They've never got the issue to work for them electorally, yet here we are, 10 months out from an election, and the NPA is going back to its old tricks on this one, and it just disappointed because they're going to throw a very winnable election at this point if they don't pivot onto stuff people actually care about.
Well, maybe they're just getting this out of their system now and just using it as a trial balloon to go, oh, does this work? Nope. All right, we'll talk about literally anything else that people actually care about now, but I'm not that optimistic.
The whole idea of going to a dedicated bridge is, like, it's clearly the worst option. Even if you just do a very rough back-of-the-envelope estimate on how much it would cost compared to the... Hell, even just the time it would take to send it back to staff to look at would not be worth it, because it is just so obviously wrong. You'd be spending thousands of dollars of city staff labor on this to come back with a... No, your idea is an order of magnitude at a minimum more expensive. So, yeah, it's just the whole thing makes you want to shake your head. There's a version of the NPA that can win this next election if they actually focus on, you know, affordability, the fiscal responsibility stuff they're in theory there to champion. But looks like they slightly lost their way recently on this one.
Well, that's as good as place of any to pick up the best of BC Poly for this week, because I think a lot of the best tweets came not from Melissa DeGenova, MPA counselor, but following her. So her tweet was before this motion was voted on, and she said, "How do you feel about losing a lane for cars, all caps, on the Cambie Street Bridge for a bike lane, all caps in those emphases? Sign up by 9:30 a.m. tomorrow to speak to council. Follow link below, blah, blah, blah." She ended up getting 202 replies to 23 likes as of the time we are recording, which Dave Moscrop at David_Moscrop subtweeted, "Learning moment. This is what we call getting, quote, ratioed. It's also what you get for being an anti-urbanist and for abusing all caps."
The whole thread there was just gold. There were a bunch of great replies. Scott M. at Apukwa, that's APUKWA, replied, "I feel great about it. So glad you asked slash shouted."
There was another thread that followed this where eventually got to the point where at Bill McCreary said, "Why not bike ferries in False Creek?"
You know, so you know, to preserve the bridge for cars.
And we have ferries. We have little small ferries, but we could have more. But Mark Allerton escalated this and said, "Why not have cyclists carried across the water in the grip of a giant bird?"
To which Patrick Johnstone at PJ New West, the New West City Councilor, replied, "Any bird large enough would be difficult to train. I'm thinking a trebuchet-based solution may be more practical."
This is what we like to see. This is top-notch subtweeting and retweeting, and just lots of snark. Keep it up. On other topics, there was an interesting tweet out of Kamloops where Donovan Cavers, at Donovan Cavers, who was a Green candidate in the last election, he said, "Today, I, as a former MLA candidate running against him, would like to formally endorse KST MLA at Todd Stone BC for leader of the BC Liberals. He's shrewd, witty, and young enough to hold power till he and the party has had time to learn to collaborate with others." And I'm not sure how much sass is in there, but it feels
this
pretty
is about
high.
The Twitters, it's hard to convey tone.
Most of the replies seem to suggest this was a pretty heavy backhanded compliment.
And a friend of the pod, Justin McElroy, had a rather amusing tweet about Vision's AGM that was held this past Monday, which neither of us attended because we were talking to Jim Milligan at that time. Also, we're not members. But a bunch of interesting stuff happened. But the part he pointed out was, quote, "unfortunate symbolism alert," as at Mayor Dreger, Dreger Robertson, approached the stage at the Vision AGM, the party's large sign behind him began to tip over.
And he did tweet it with an image that we'll include in the show notes on the website. So,
just everything that could possibly.
It's not as bad as Hillary Clinton's venue on election night where she had a literal glass ceiling above where she didn't come out. It's always unfortunate when those little technical things happen. And finally, following Tom Davidoff's tweet that we mentioned last week, Kay Teschke at K Teschke tweets, "Any chance you," meaning Tom Davidoff, "might run for mayor? A chance to apply all your innovative ideas?" And Tom replies, "Thanks, but no one's going to elect a balding, outspoken real estate personality from New York to any position of prominence." Well, and finally, both a shout out and an apology for how I'm going to butcher this, but to Lucas Agagnier at Real Lucas A for playing along on Twitter and suggesting tweets from Keith Baldry, Andrew Weaver, and Devin Rowcliffe, some of which we mentioned earlier in this show, so we didn't include them here, for using hashtag best of BC Poly to nominate a few tweets there.
He rose to the occasion, and we're expecting the rest of our listeners to follow through.
So yeah, feel free to DM us tweets, use hashtag best of BC Poly, or otherwise just try to bring them to our attention.
And that has been Politicos. Find links to the stories we mentioned in the show notes at politicos.ca. Make sure to subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts and follow us on Facebook and Twitter at politicospod. Leave us a review and let us know what you think. Support the show and get early access to our interviews at patreon.com/politicoast. And if you have ideas for the show, feel free to send them to us. Thanks for listening.